only because it deals with the laws of Yom Tov. And it has the advantage and disadvantage of having a large number of topics. I mean, sometimes when we give the shiur in here, we concentrate on one subject for a whole year, like we're learning the laws of Agunot or the laws of Shal Shabbat and things like that. So that's one approach. It has advantages that you cover one topic thoroughly, but it has a disadvantage that you get tired, or people who have missed out on some things lose the continuity. This Masechta has the advantage of a scattershot approach to many different topics, and we will take that approach. But the first thing that we have to do is study the beginning of the Masechta. So let's first just read the beginning of the Mishnah, and then let me summarize the discussion in the Gemara. The Mishnah says, Beit Sasha nolda b'yom tov, Beit Shammai omrim te'achel, u'Beit Hillel omrim lo te'achel. So the first thing that strikes us in this Mishnah, you in the Mishnah is that there's a reversal of position here between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. That is, that Beit Shammai take the lenient position and Beit Hillel take the rigid position. And the Mishnah is so struck by that also that it lists several other occurrences which are not really related to this particular problem because this is such an unusual position. But what's strange about this halacha, what is strange, I think, for us, is the concept that there should be an Issur Achila on Yom Kippur. We're not accustomed to it. In other words, we know that you can't eat on Yom Kippur. We know that you can't eat chametz on Pesach. But the idea of associating a prohibition against eating with Yom Tov is certainly something a priori which is far into our intuitive concept, right? The whole idea of Yom Tov is to eat, and therefore, and our conception of things like the laws of Muktzah have to do with not carrying them, or perhaps in the popular mind, not touching them. But to formulate this prohibition as a prohibition of Achila for us appears a little bit strange. At any event, that's what the Mishnah says, Lo Te'achel. Then the Mishnah goes, as Dr. Kahn suggests, into a whole list of topics where Beit Shammai is Mekel and Beit Hillel is Machmir. So it says, Beit Shammai omrim sa'or b'kezayit b'chametz b'kevodevet, that there's a difference as far as shiurim are concerned between sourdough and just chametz, that the dough that's used as leavening, as souring agent for other bread, has the status of Isur in a smaller unit than Chametz. But Beit Hillel omrim zeva zeva kazayit. Hashochet chayav ha'ofi yom tov Beit Shammai omrim yachpor b'deke v'yachaseh. Beit Hillel omrim lo yishchot elim ken hayalo afal buchan mivu'od yom. U'modim she'im shachat she'yachpor b'deke v'yachaseh. And then a strange phrase, which the Gemara corrects later on, she'afal kira buchan. The Gemara says that shah should be replaced by a vav. It's not causally connected with what went before. All right, so that's the list of differences, basically, between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, where Beit Shammai takes the lenient position. But the Gemara has trouble understanding the Mishnah. In other words, we have trouble understanding the Mishnah, and that's not too surprising, but the Gemara has trouble understanding the Mishnah. In other words, the Gemara author, and we will read the Gemara after my broad introduction for this whole thing, the Gemara offers two major hypotheses as to what the Mishnah is talking about. One hypothesis is that the Mishnah is talking about the laws of Moses. And the second hypothesis is put forward by Rabbah, is that the Mishnah is talking about a strange halacha, namely the halacha of hachana. And to explain how strange this halacha is, and that's the conclusion of the Gemara, by the way. The Gemara essentially rejects the notion of muktzah. Why, we will study as we go along, but the formulation of Rabbah and which is the principal formulation as far as the most Rishonim accept this as the actual interpretation of the Mishnah, is that first of all, mainly the Mishnah is not talking about any Yom Tov, but it's talking about a Yom Tov that comes on a Sunday. It doesn't say anything about that in the Mishnah, but it says, I'm saying that the Mishnah is talking about Yom Tov.
Okay.
Secondly, Rabbah introduces two hypotheses, one having to do with halacha and another having to do with biology, and that will give us a short report on the biological aspects pretty soon. The halachic concept here is a notion of hacham. And I'll formulate it now and then we'll formulate it again, because again it appears strange to an untutored ear. The halacha of hachana has the following. One, that all the meals of Shabbat or Yom Tov have a certain intrinsic importance. This intrinsic importance demands that they be prepared, or at least in principle be prepared, that is, exist in a form that is construed as being mukhan on the day prior to Yom Tov. Third, that day should be chol. So if an object was in and of itself created on Shabbat, if the Chag falls out on Sunday, then this principle of Ahechinu et Asher Heviu demands that that object retain an Isur Achila on Yom Tov. In other words, this is not that you did something on Shabbat. It's not a prohibition or a gzeirah against your having performed an act. But natural acts which take place on the day before a Yom Tov, which make foodstuffs ready, are considered hachana, and are considered hachana to the extent that if this event occurs on a day which is not chol, in other words, if the chag occurs on a Sunday and the previous day is Shabbat, then these objects which reach their final stage of creation on the day before the Chag are prohibited, are asur ba'achila on the Chag. That's the halachic aspect. That in and of itself is strange to us. It's strange because the Mishnah doesn't mention anything about Sunday, and it's strange because why should there be such an issur? The Hechinu et Asher Heviu, which is the pasuk that Rabbah brings, of course, is referring to what you're supposed to do or what you're not supposed to do. That is, you're supposed to go out and gather the man, a double portion, on Friday so that you have it on Shabbat. And Rabbah is interpreting that Behechinu et Asher Heviu as a Isur if the object itself was not prepared on a Yom Chol or Shabbat or Yom Tov. And then this is supplemented by a biological hypothesis, which is that the egg in its shell is completed 24 hours before it's actually laid. So that therefore, if this Beitzah is laid on Sunday, and that Sunday is a Chag, then that means that the egg itself was finished, was completed on Shabbat, and therefore this was a Hachana of Shabbat for Yom Tov, and this makes the object also on Yom Tov. We'll hear now from Mel about what the actual biological facts are.
Here's a picture of the inside of the chicken. Here. So,
ovulation takes place within 6 or 8 hours after the release of a high level of a hormone produced by the pituitary gland. The release of the hormone is related to the time of onset of darkness, and it normally occurs between midnight and about 8 a.m. It follows that the hen always ovulates in daylight. Moreover, since it takes about 24 hours after ovulation to complete the formation of the egg is also laid during the daylight hours. After the ovum is released from the follicle, it is engulfed by the funnel-like infundibulum of the oviduct.
This thing.
It is here that the egg is fertilized in hens that have been mated. As the yolk passes along the oviduct, layers of albumen are laid down in the magnum. Here's the magnum. The proteins of the albumin, which constitute the egg white, are synthesized in the magnum from amino acids removed from the blood. The synthesis is continuous, and in the periods between the passage of yolks down the oviduct, albumin is stored in the tissue of the magnum. The addition of the layers of albumin to the yolk takes about 4 hours. The next stage in the formation of the egg is the laying down of two shell membranes, an inner one and an outer one, around the albumin. The membranes are formed in a thin tubular isthmus. When the membranes are first laid down, they cover the albumin tightly, but they soon stretch. By the time the egg enters the shell gland, they fit quite loosely. The egg passes the next 5 hours in the process known as pumping. This entails the entry of water and salts through the membranes until the egg is swollen. The pumping period appears to be an essential preliminary to the main process of shell calcification, which occupies the next 15 to 16 hours. The shell is composed of calcite, which is one of the crystalline forms of calcium carbonate. A sparse matrix of protein runs through the crystals of the shell. The final stage in the formation of the egg is the deposition of a cuticle on the fully calcified egg shell. This is accomplished just before the egg is laid.
So therefore, what you're saying to me is, to us, is that the egg leaves the follicle essentially 24 hours before it's laid. So,
but that's a little shock.
And 15 of the 24 is occupied with
putting the albumin on.
Putting the shell.
But it's still about the
calcification.
How much?
No, he says that it's laid after 24 hours
after that.
So, of course, that's what it says in the Scientific American. So there is a fact that the egg is actually leaving the follicle 24 hours before it is laid, but whether you're going to interpret that as the nolad that we're concerned with, that is, that is, the Gemara is interpreted as leaving the follicle or not, that may be reading into the Gemara more scientific information that they actually had. But at least we now know, according to the Scientific American, what the facts of the laying of the eggs are.
Okay.
So in any event, we have this biological hypothesis. Let's agree that Rabba was prescient and realized that the egg, he defined the formulation of the egg as when it leaves the follicle, and that takes place 24 hours before the egg is actually laid. The problem is that that whole interpretation of the Mishnah is extremely far-fetched. That is, to introduce a halacha like this that we may not have heard of before, and have this biological hypothesis, the whole thing is very difficult. And before we even begin to study the Gemara, I think we have to ask ourselves, why do we, and especially why does the Gemara have such difficulty in understanding the Mishnah? The Gemara asks proposes four alternative explanations of the Mishnah. As I said, two principal ones are the laws of Muktzah and the laws of Hachana. And then there are two subsidiary interpretations having to do with very narrowly based Zerot, that is, Shemaya Levi Yitlosh, that is, against eating a fruit that falls off a tree, or the usage of liquid that is automatically drained or squeezed out of the fruit. All four of those explanations are really hard to imagine, so I think we're stuck with the fact that we really don't understand the Mishnah too well. And before, as I said, before going into the details of how the Gemara tries to understand the Mishnah, I think we have to ask ourselves the broader question of why is this Mishnah so hard for us to understand, and hard for the Gemara to understand. And I think that the secret of that lies in a rather more complicated class of questions. There are very few situations, there are some of course, but there are relatively few situations in which the Gemara engages in a historical analysis of the halacha. You know, there's sometimes where it says Mishnah Rishonah and so on. There are There are half a dozen or a dozen of them. But one of the places where the Gemara definitely does engage in a historical analysis of the halacha is the laws of Muktzah. At least those aspects of the laws of Muktzah that have to do with the laws of Netilat, of Tiltul Kelim. The Mishnah and Shabbat says, for those of you who have my handout, it's on page 5 of that handout. The Mishnah and Shabbat.
Do you have any more copies?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Let's see what I have in the box. I just didn't know how many people could expect it.
Well, okay.
I made too few out of it.
Okay. I can borrow one.
Yeah.
Run one off.
Okay. All right. We're not going to make all that much use of this, but let's take a look. The Mishnah says, Rabbi Yossi Omer, or is it Kukav Gimel on the base, Kukav Dalit, something like that. In Kol HaKelim, in the Masechet Shabbat, Rabbi Yossi Omer, you can get a Masechet Shabbat. I mean, this is, we're just going to read it, and we can find the Gemara Shabbat. You know, Rabbi Yossi Omer, Kol HaKelim Nitalin, you're allowed to carry all types of utensils, Chutz Min HaMesar HaGadol V'Yatei Shel Machrisha, except for a large knife or the blade of a plow. Okay?
Yeah.
Masechet Shabbat. Rashi says, Mesa Hagadol, Megeva Gedola Shasuya L'Kitzot Tzkarot, a large saw that's used to cut up firewood, V'Yatei Shel Machrisha, Kli Gadol Ha'asui Kesakin, Shubo Usin Harit Shel Telem, Hama'aneh, called Tura Balaz. This is the blade of a plow, and that culture is the same word as culture, like in agriculture. Okay? The Hanach, Rashi explains, Kapir Alayu, these are precious utensils. These are expensive and precious utensils that you would normally not use for any other purpose. You would put them aside before Shabbat, and therefore this is a kli which has this special status of being precious and therefore not usable on Shabbat. But all other utensils are usable. Now, if we skip two or three lines down from the Mishnah, the Gemara says, "Valishana hayulam wim." Originally, the law was shlosha kelim nitalim b'Shabbat. There are three utensils which can be carried on Shabbat. Miktsoa shel dvela, a sort of a flat knife for cutting up pressed fruit. Vezuha malistrin shel kidera, or a large spoon to stir up the pot. Vesakim ktana shel agabei ha'shulchan, and the table knife to use for cutting up food. Remember, things like forks and maybe even spoons and other forms of silverware are relatively late introductions into society, 15th, 16th, maybe even later centuries. In the old days, you had a knife, but you certainly didn't have a fork. You used your fingers and or whatever you could, huh?
Was a lot of the Mishnah for forks? Had forks.
Hmm?
He had forks.
Mazleg.
Good.
Not as eating cutlery usual. What I'm talking here about, I mean, for cooking and things like that, or for pitchforks and stuff. Okay. All right. So basically, if we were going to formulate this law, what the Mishnah is saying is that in the old days, the only type of utensil that you were allowed to carry on or to move around on Shabbat was tableware, silverware, right? Or a spoon for the pot. But basically, all other utensils you were not allowed to carry on Shabbat. Hetiru. No. You're just simply not allowed to pick up any utensil on Shabbat. You're not allowed to pick up a needle. You're not allowed to pick up a pen. You're not allowed to pick up a hammer. You're not allowed to pick up a nutcracker. You're not allowed to pick up a hanger. No utensil was allowed to be carried on Shabbat, with the exception of these small group of items which we would characterize as tableware.
Yeah, things you could do some work with. With the forbinder.
No, things, not only things that you had to do with
unlocking. Did you mention a hanger? Or?
Yeah. Okay. So what I'm saying is, Bavishanayu omim shlosha kelim nitalim b'shabbat mitzor shel v'elav zoma shel lispin shel k'teira v'sakim k'tana shel gavei ha'shulchan hetiru v'chazru v'hetiru v'chazru v'hetiru. There was a gradual and repeated relaxation of the laws, right? Until they finally reached the conclusion that kol hakelim nitalim mishabbat chutz mimesa hagadol v'yateid mishal macharishah. In other words, this Mishnah, the Gemara is entering into a historical analysis of the Mishnah and saying that this Mishnah is the end of a process of relaxation of the laws of Muktzah. Originally, the laws of Muktzah were so severe, the laws of Yisur Tumtum Kelim were so severe that with three exceptions, you weren't allowed to carry anything around. And now the situation is the reverse, that with some small exceptions, you are allowed to carry any utensil around. Now the Gemara goes into some discussion. My hetiru v'chazru v'hetiru v'chazru v'hetiru. What is this steady triple relaxation of the laws? Amari baye hetiru davar shemlachto leheter letzorech gufo. As far as the laws of tiltul kelim are concerned, which is a sub branch of Hilchot Muktzah, we have to differentiate two types, two broad categories of kelim, and three types of usages. There's a notion of a kli shemlachto leisur and a kli shemlachto leheter. There are special types of kelim which are prohibited because of machmat isur or machmat chisaron kis, like in the Mishnah, or machmat nius. But broadly, all utensils, as far as the laws of Muktzah are concerned, fall into two categories: a utensil whose primary purpose is to accomplish some work which is prohibited on Shabbat, a pen, a hammer, a screwdriver, a needle. Right? The principal usage of a needle is for sewing. You might on occasion use the needle as a toothpick or to dig out a splinter or what have you, but primarily a needle is used to sew, and sewing is a melacha on Shabbat, and therefore a needle is classified as a kli shemlachto leisur. And then the other class of kelim are those utensils whose intended usage, they're made to do something which is permitted on Shabbat, like a fork or a knife or a nutcracker or what have you. Okay? So those are two types of kelim. And now the Gemara, two broad classes of kelim, and the Gemara also has three possible reasons why you might want to move a utensil around. Okay. One reason is letzorech gufo, to use it. In other words, you want to pick up this needle and use it to dig out a splinter. So you're using a utensil whose primary purpose is for something that's prohibited. The nature of the kli makes it melachto isu, but you're using it for a purpose which is permissible, but you want to use the utensil. A second type of reason for carrying a utensil around is because you need the place. You want to get it out of the way. Right? You have a great big TV set sitting on the table, and you want to move it off so that you should be allowed, so you should be able to sit down. Okay? That's letzorech makomo. And the third class of usages is what is for the protection of the utensil itself, right? You left your TV set out on the porch, and you're worried now that it's starting to rain, you want to bring it in. That's what's called mechamalatzeh. So we have six possibilities, two types of utensils and three types of usages. Okay, so now Baye says, Amar Baye, Hetiru davar shemlachto leheter letzorech gufo. The first two relaxations refer to a kli shemachtel leheter. They originally allowed you to use it. Remember, in the olden days, you weren't even allowed to pick up a nutcracker, even to crack the nuts with. Or you weren't allowed to pick up a hanger, even to hang up your clothes with, even though it's a kli shemachtel leheter, and the act was permissible. The very fact that you were using a utensil made it prohibited. So they relaxed those laws in two stages. One is that you're allowed to pick up the nutcracker to crack the nut, or to pick up the hanger to hang your clothes. And secondly, you're allowed to pick them up to get them out of the way.
Okay? To pick up a hammer to open the nut.
And then v'chazru v'etiru v'avar shemalachto le'isu l'tzarach gufo. And then they finally came to the stage of Mr. Fried's suggestion that you're allowed to take a kli shemalachto le'isu, like a hammer, and use it for a permissible purpose. Okay, so according to Abaye, then the final stage in the relaxation of these laws was that you're allowed to use a klishim lachtol, move a klishim lachtol leheter for two out of the three reasons. That is, letzorach gufo ulusaf makomo, but not mechama letzeya. And a kli shemalachto le'isur, you're only allowed to carry for one out of the three reasons. You're allowed to pick up the hammer, as Mr. Fried says, to open up the walnut, but you're not allowed to pick it up to get it off the table, and you're certainly not allowed to move it indoors if you're worried that someone's going to steal it. Well, okay. The tzarach gufo, in the tzarach makomo lo. V'adayin Abaye says, v'yado achat in, if this is a sufficiently small utensil that you can pick it up with one hand, yes, v'shtei yadav lo. But if it's big and bulky, that requires some effort in moving it, even a kli shemachto leheter would not be allowed to be moved on Shabbat. Okay? Ad she'amru, until the final relaxation of these laws was shekola kevin mitalin b'shabbat afilu b'shneyadai, that the size of the utensil doesn't matter. If one man can move them, then it's permissible. Amale Rava mifdi hetiru katani, since they said hetiru, that they relaxed the laws, mali l'tzarach kufo mali l'tzarach mekomo, what should it matter whether I'm going to use the utensil or I'm simply trying to get it out of the way? Ela amar Rava, heitiru davar shemalachto leheter, bein letzarach gufo ubein letzarach makomo. A kli shemalachto leheter, a nutcracker or a hanger, you're allowed to move either to use or to get it out of the way. And then they went one step further and said, you're allowed to bring your nutcracker in from the porch because you're afraid that someone will steal it if you leave it outside. For its own protection, you're allowed to move it. V'chazuv lachtol isur l'tzach kufal l'tzach mekomo. In mechama l'tzeil lo. So according to Rava, and that's how we, but that's the final decision of the halacha, a kli shemalachto leheter can be moved for any of these three reasons, and kli shemalachto leisur can only be moved for two out of the three. The one remaining purpose, that is carrying a kli shemalachto leisur for its own protection, is still prohibited on Shabbat. So if your TV set is left outside on the porch and you want to bring it in because you're afraid it'll be stolen, you're not allowed to do that on Shabbat. But to get it off the table, or to move a hammer for usage, you're allowed. So the only remaining prohibition as far as the carrying of utensils are concerned is the carrying of a kli shemalachto leisur, a utensil whose principal usage is a prohibited act, mechama letzeil, in order to protect it. They still limited this to something that at least one person can carry, but if it was a great big utensil that only two people could carry, you were not allowed to carry it on Shabbat. Ad she'amru kol hakelim nitalim b'Shabbat v'afilu b'shnei b'yad adam. Okay. Then the Gemara asks a couple of questions. Eifei Abaye Meduchan Yesh shu metaltelin, metaltelin yav, ein metaltelin yotah, hachot omay eskin ha mechama letze. Eichi vishavim shev tzavel av atzor, shesu atatlo hachanami mechama letze. Amar Rabbi Hanina, vimei nechem yoven chachalya nishnet mishnah zu. Our mishnah here of lechtiv, v'yamim ha'ema, ra'iti v'yudah dochim gatot v'shabat, ומביאים הרימות, that he saw that there was gross violations of the Shabbat, and therefore the Gemara is assuming that these laws were enacted sometime towards the, all of these laws of Muktzah were enacted at some time towards the beginning of Bayit Sheni. Okay, Amar Rabbi Elazar, Kanin u'maklot u'sram u'duchal, kulam kolim hatarat kelim nishn. Now that we have this historical analysis that there has been a gross relaxation in the laws of Muktzah, then Rabbi Elazar says that a whole slew, he lists four, we won't go into it now, maybe we'll study these examples next week, there's a whole list of various Mishnayot which seem to be difficult to understand according to our current laws of Muktzah, and therefore Rabbi Elazar can explain that all of these were before this relaxation of the laws. Okay?
So it's an issue, so what happened then? Was there that was formulated before, formulate the Isur laws, right?
The Mishnah is, the Gemara is telling us that the laws of Muktzah were very, very severe at one stage. Let's divide this up into several portions. The Gemara is telling us that the laws of Muktzah were very, very severe at one stage, and then they underwent a process of relaxation. Okay. Until our final formulation of these laws is almost the opposite, at least as far as the laws of Muktzah are concerned, than they originally were. Originally, you were not allowed to move any utensil at all. The very fact that it was a utensil made it prohibited to carry on Shabbat. It was an Isur Tiltul Kelim, and that there were some small exceptions for necessary things like eating at the table. But the idea was that the fact that something was a utensil made it prohibited to be carried on Shabbat. And at the end of this process of relaxation of the laws, the fact that something was a utensil essentially was something that made it possible to be carried on Shabbat. That is, our laws of Muktzah, the way we have them now, are so formulated that something which is not foodstuff and not a utensil, like an animal or a piece of raw material and something you're not allowed to carry on Shabbat, not allowed to move around on Shabbat, but a utensil, for instance, you are allowed to move around, with the exception of, say, a kli shemlachto l'isur l'tzor mechama l'tzeil, or with the exception of certain very particular utensils, as mentioned in the Mishnah, where they're so precious that you put them aside not for use on Shabbat.
So, but the speed laws were established by Nechem.
Now that's a separate issue. In addition to this, the Gemara is offering an additional hypothesis that these laws of Muktzah were established by Nechem.
The strict laws. Because there was a violation.
That's how the Gemara is interpreting. Okay? So, let's see if we can understand what the Gemara is telling us historically. And we'll see that I think that this is part of an overall problem here. But the Gemara is saying that somehow before the time of Nehemiah, the laws of Shabbat weren't all that strict. We didn't have such things as the laws of Isur and Netilat Kelim and so on. Nehemiah came along and introduced, during the period of Bayit Sheni, the laws of Shabbat, at least as far as the Din of Muktzah are concerned, were extremely strict. They were gradually relaxed until they reached the stage that we have them today. Okay, that's what the Gemara is saying. Let us go back to my original question as to why is it so hard for us to understand the Mishnah. I think that it's so hard for us to understand the Mishnah because what the Gemara tells us as far as the law of the Mishnah and Beitzah, what the Gemara is telling us as far as the laws of Muktzah are concerned, I think apply far more generally to the laws of Shabbat as a whole. If we take a look at any historical picture that we have, and I confess that they're limited, as to what the laws of Shabbat were like before the time of the Mishnah, and the, what the laws of Shabbat are like after being formulated by the Mishnah, we see a very broad relaxation of the laws. And I think we discussed this at some length in the shiurim of last year or 2 years ago, but let's give some illustrations of that. First of all, from the Achitzonim themselves. I mean, if you look in the Book of Maccabees, the chapters dealing with not fighting on Shabbat and so on, you see that this whole notion of pikuach nefesh to the Shabbat wasn't certainly terribly accepted before a particular instance in history. The story of Shimon ben Shetach executing a person for riding on a horse on Shabbat. The Gemara has difficulty with that and says that this is an instance where a court can mishum hora'at sha'ah can give a strict penalty, even though it doesn't apply, but it can apply even dinei nefashot in the case where they regard it as hora'at sha'ah. But the simplest interpretation is that at one stage, riding on a horse on Shabbat was considered as a capital offense. The explanation that the Gemara gives for the prohibition of riding on a horse, I mean, it's extraordinarily far-fetched. We may have been accustomed to it because we talked with it as children, but the Gemara says that you're not allowed to ride on a horse on Shabbat because you might cut a branch off a tree to use as a switch to beat the horse with. I think that common sense says that that's a relatively far-fetched explanation for such a broad prohibition. The simplest interpretation is that the notion, either that the notion of using an animal for riding on it may have been prohibited, the Torah after all says Leman Yonuach, or more to the point, the notion of travel on Shabbat was strictly prohibited. And all of the problems of Hilchot Tchumim that the Gemara has difficulty with indicate this similar gradual relaxation.
But traveling depends on distance.
Not traveling. Distance, the idea of going around where to a place which you normally wouldn't reach on foot. The idea of riding on a horse, I think, is as strange to a person, say, in the second, towards the end of Bayit Sheni, as it would be strange for you to ride on the key on Shabbat. You would find it difficult to get on the trolley on Shabbat or Yom Tov. Right? Well, let's come to that. I want to come to that. That's a very important point. But I want to first try to formulate this in a way that we can understand the psychology and the history of what's happening. As we've mentioned several times, and it's worth repeating, the notion, the list of the Lamed Tet Melachot is certainly something which is extremely late. And the evidence that it's extremely late is clear because it appears in the seventh parak of Shabbat between two Mishnayot, which obviously were originally connected to one another. The Mishnah says, Klal Gadol Amu B'Shabbat, etc. And then the old Klal Acher, and that's the standard literary form of the Mishnah, Klal Gadol, and then some other subsidiary Klal. And stuck in between these two is Avot Melacha, Arba'im Chaser Achad, etc. So that list of the 40 Melachot, that's one, the 39 Melachot on Shabbat, is something which obviously came into existence relatively late, probably after, or certainly after, the initial formulation of the text of the Mishnah. We find throughout Masechet Shabbat and in other places questions as to why a particular act is forbidden on Shabbat, right? Megaven asur mishum mai. What is the avalacha that prohibits you from making cheese on Shabbat? Mishum mai. What's the prohibition, right? And then the Gemara says mishum this, that, mishum cholev. In other words, the Gemara repeatedly has difficulty in putting a particular prohibited act, which it knows is prohibited, and finding the appropriate category in which to formulate it. And some of the Amoraim simply say that it's just prohibited, and they refuse to accept the rather artificial category. So what we're finding is that the notion of Avot Melacha, that the formulation that what is prohibited on Shabbat is, as we now formulated, a creative act that has to do with one of the stages of industrial production. Or more precisely, the Gemara tries to antedate it to the Mishkan, but when you look at the list, it's the stages of industrial production at the time of the Mishnah, that one of the creative acts which is associated with industrial production, that these 39 categories are what constitute a prohibition on Shabbat, the Avot Melacha, and anything else either has to be squeezed into one of these categories if it doesn't fit, or is formulated as a gzeva. There's no question in my mind that riding on a horse is prohibited for an ancient period of time. And then, since it doesn't fall into any of these categories, we might have to search around to find a reason why this thing which was prohibited earlier remains prohibited. So, there's been a tendency amongst the Achronim I've mentioned it in connection with the Chazanish many times in this shiur, but here I have a particularly acute citation from the Nitziv as well. There's a sort of a tendency amongst the Achronim in dealing with the question of what is a Dioraita or what is a Rabbanan, to say that the Dinim Dioraita were given in some form of general principle, that the precise formulation of these laws and what constituted a Din Dioraita or not was given to Chazal to establish, right? We've read the Chazanish many times on here, but if there's an interesting citation on my page 15, if you look in the Sid, dealing precisely with the laws of Muktzah. Okay? On the right-hand column, about 3 or 4 lines after the text begins, Pain Emet, do you have it? Pain Emet, the Muktzah of Rabbi Nachman. The muktzah of a chicken which has been meant to lay eggs is certainly relevant. From the law, from the pasuk of Vehechinu et Asher Heviu, we only learned Ela Ikar Din Muktzah, the principle that there exists something like Muktzah, the Yesh Davar Shechaser Hachana, that there is a concept, a legal concept of something that is missing Hachana, V'Asur La'Ochlo, and you're not allowed to eat it. This, as a Din Dioraita, we've been told, Aval Davar Zeh, this object, this principle of law, Nitan L'Chachamim, it was given to the Chazal to formulate Mahu Muktzah Dioraita U'Mahu D'Rabbana. In other words, the principle of Muktzah was given in HaTorah, that's a notion of Dioraita, but the actual decision of which aspects of this law are to be construed as Yisurim Dioraita and which aspects of this law are to be construed as Yisurim D'Rabbanan were given to Chazal to determine. It's a strange formulation, right? That the legislative decision on the part of Chazal has now decided which of these laws are the Dioraita and which of these laws are the Rabbanan. The Chazanish goes even further. Maybe I should read him to remind you of what he says. He is talking about in the laws of Eid Echad B'Isha, a single witness is accepted for the testimony of a missing husband, that husband died. And there are a number of different explanations in the Rishonim as to how Chazal could explicitly go against what it says in the Torah of Al Pishnei Edim or Shlosha Edim Yakum Davar, and here they're admitting a single witness. And one of the explanations is the explanation of Tosfot, V'yesh Koach V'yad Chachamim La'akor Davar Min HaTorah, that the Chazal have a right to legislate, even to uproot a second. Now, of course, I think if you ask anyone around this table, or at least people who, before we studied the Chazon Ish several times over the past few years, what that means, the simplest interpretation of that means is that in situations where there's some emergency or some need, Chazal have the right to enact some legislation which goes against an accepted din d'oraita. How? What gives them that power? By what means they do that? Is it going to be through some legal fiction, through some other mechanism, like in the case of Rose Bowl or what have you? All right, that's a technicality. But the simplest interpretation of Yesh Koach B'Yad Chachamim L'Hakol Davar Min HaTorah, before we would read it in the Chazon Ish, is that the Chazal, on special, very needful, very difficult situations, have the right to overrule a din d'oraita, to uproot. But let's see how the Chazon Ish interprets this. The Da'at Tosfot, the Yesh Koach B'Yad Chachamim La'akor Davar Min HaTorah, for Davar Sheyesh Lo Ta'am, V'Hainu. Listen to his words carefully, because they're practically identical with what we saw in the Nesir. The mitchila nitna Torah al da chachamim lahachriya, ma nikra yediya ve'ei lahatirei shetit. That the Torah originally empowered Chazal to determine what constitutes sufficient evidence as far as allowing a woman to remarry. In other words, the formulation of the rules of evidence were given to the Chazal. They were empowered to decide this. V'chachamim yekvu'u b'zeh chukim k'ruim l'chol Yisrael. And the Chazal will then decide this for everybody. Oh, kol beit din l'bnei Iran. Or perhaps each local court will establish the rule of evidence in its own jurisdiction. V'kol shelo kavu ha-beit din,